This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 9th of March, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast. In Washington, lawmakers attempt to break gridlock as another government shutdown looms. We'll take a look at efforts to combat anti-Muslim sentiment ahead of controversial hearings by Congress member Peter King. And we go to Thailand, where advocates want to push for better water management to help deal with the country's drought. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today in Illinois, an announcement from Governor Pat Quinn.
It is impossible to create a perfect system, one that is free of all mistakes, free of all discrimination with respect to race or economic circumstance or geography. To have a consistent, perfect death penalty system, I have concluded after looking at everything I've been given that that's impossible in our state. I think it's the right and just thing to abolish the death penalty.
Quinn said he would abolish the death penalty, making Illinois the 16th state in the nation to outlaw the practice. FSRN's Chris Giovannis reports.
Anti-death penalty groups marshaled thousands of phone calls to Governor Quinn asking him to support the ban passed by the state legislature. Quinn's decision came in spite of aggressive support for the death penalty from several groups, including the Illinois State's Attorneys Association. The death penalty in Illinois has drawn harsh criticism in recent years. More than a dozen inmates were found to have been wrongfully convicted, including several who said their confessions were extracted under police torture. In 2000, then-Governor George Ryan imposed a moratorium on the death penalty. 3 years later, he commuted the sentences of all 157 death row inmates to life in prison, calling the use of the death penalty in Illinois arbitrary and capricious. Chris Giovannis, FSRN, Chicago.
Thousands of labor union workers, state employees, and teachers marched in more than 30 rallies in major cities from Miami to Tallahassee yesterday to protest the largest annual budget cuts to education in Florida's history. WMNF Community Radio's Joshua Holton reports from the largest of the Awake the State protests in Tampa.
Governor Rick Scott ran on an election platform for job creation that insisted, "Let's get to work." But at Tuesday's rally in Tampa, Lynn Webb, president of the local Central Labor Council, joined a crowd of more than 1,000 protesters, asking, "Where's the jobs?"
Governor Scott wants to cut 8,000 public service union jobs. His proposed budget will lay off 40,000 teachers and school employees.
President of the Hillsborough County PTA, Melissa Erickson, added that Governor Scott is required by the Florida Constitution to properly fund high-quality education.
And then he proceeded to propose $3.3 billion in cuts. That is unacceptable.
Yesterday's rallies coincided with the opening of the Florida legislative session, aiming to stop the proposed cuts and also to show solidarity with teachers and union advocates in Wisconsin. Joshua Holton, FSRN, Tampa.
Pro-worker rallies were also held in six other U.S. states yesterday, including Indiana, Ohio, Iowa, Michigan, and Tennessee. In Idaho, the legislature succeeded in pushing through an anti-union bill that stripped many collective bargaining rights from the state's teachers. The Republican governor is expected to sign the bill into law. Fighting continued today in Libya, where military forces loyal to Muammar Gaddafi maintained a strike on opposition forces in the cities of Zawiya and Bin Jawad. A Zawiya resident told the Washington Post that humanitarian aid is needed in the city. On Monday, Israeli authorities closed off one of the final two commercial border crossings into Gaza, but today they reopened another crossing that's been closed for 4 years and began to allow some building supplies to enter the coastal territory. FSRN's Rami Omagari has more.
Palestinian sources in Gaza are downplaying the reopening of the Safa commercial crossing in southeastern Gaza as inadequate. Today, Israeli authorities allowed only 10 truckloads of concrete to pass, all destined for UN-sponsored construction projects. Nahed Shaber is a spokesperson for the Courier Companies Association in Gaza. He was supervising the movement of trucks at Sofa earlier today.
Up to this moment, the Sufa crossing has not gotten back to normal. For the past 5 years, we have been waiting on entry of at least 72,000 tons of concrete that's been held up on the Israeli side of the border.
The Sofa reopening comes just 2 days after Israel sealed off a major commercial crossing in southeastern Gaza. Since then, truck drivers have been on strike at the borders, and displaced Palestinians who need the concrete to rebuild their homes have been protesting. Rami Al-Mighari, FSRN, Gaza.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. After weeks of gridlock in the nation's capital, the Senate finally debated and then soundly rejected two separate partisan budgets today. Matt Laszlo reports on the lingering budget battle from Washington.
A budget is dollars and cents, but lawmakers of both parties agree it's also a political document that lays out specific priorities. This is how Washington State Democratic Senator Patty Murray describes the federal budget.
Our nation's budget is a statement of our values, our priorities, and our vision for what kind of country we will be handing off to our children and our grandchildren.
Because Congress didn't pass a budget last year, lawmakers need to pass a temporary budget to keep the government running through the end of the year. Current funding runs out on March 18th. Senate Democrats offered a budget that cut spending by $4.7 billion. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell laughed that number off.
At a time when Washington is borrowing about $4 billion a day, Democratic leaders want to cut about $4.5 billion in government spending for the rest of this fiscal year and call it a day. In other words, they want to take what amounts to a day and a half long holiday from their out-of-control spending and then return to the status quo for the rest of the year.
On the Republican side of the aisle, you had a bill that first passed the House. It took aim at everything from maternity programs to education and even foreign assistance for AIDS and malaria. In total, it cut $57 billion from the budget in one fell swoop. It was a non-starter for Democrats like Senator Murray.
I am extremely disappointed that Republicans who came into office talking about the economy have proposed an extreme budget that would destroy hundreds of thousands of jobs, devastate workers and small businesses across the country, and threaten that fragile economic recovery.
Economic experts say the two parties are talking past each other. Gary Kalman is the legislative director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Groups.
There's been a lot of discussion about should we cut $100 billion, should we cut $10 billion, should we cut $50 billion. That's the wrong discussion to have.
Kalman says there are easy things to cut that aren't even being seriously debated. The Government Accountability Office says billions could be saved by just streamlining the federal bureaucracy, like the duplication it found in 44 executive employment programs. Kalman also says Congress needs to unwind billions of dollars used to prop up the oil and gas industry, but he admits it's a tough fight.
There's obviously a lot of lobbying going on from special interests and a lot of pressure to maintain what are carefully and long fought for carve-outs and handouts to special interests.
To Republicans, unwinding those tax breaks for energy companies are non-starters, especially with all the unrest in the Middle East already driving up gas prices. Minority Leader McConnell says heaping more costs on consumers will hurt the economic recovery.
It will destroy jobs and impose a real burden on families every time they fill up at the pump, at a time when people are looking for relief instead.
Jim Horney of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says the two failed partisan budgets give lawmakers more room to work.
I think it will demonstrate that we're unlikely to enact either of these different versions. And so I think it will indicate that something's got to give.
House Republicans campaigned on rolling back spending to 2008 levels. Horney says those politics may cloud the budget debate going forward.
It is clear that they think it's important. Unfortunately, much of this debate revolves around just talking about cuts in order to fulfill a campaign pledge without the careful consideration of what these cuts actually mean.
But Horney says the clock is ticking now, and he expects something to be worked out between the two parties.
I don't think that any of the leaders, certainly the president and I think both the Republican and Democratic leaders in the House and Senate, do not want to have a shutdown. I think they think that that could be harmful. I think they also believe, you know, they're afraid who will get blamed for it.
Both parties need to work out an agreement, and it necessitates a compromise on both sides. And they only have the next week and a half to get it ironed out. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Last month, the Obama administration announced it would no longer defend the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, in court. The administration said there's been a documented history of discrimination against people based on their sexual orientation. Because of this, it believes any laws dealing with sexual orientation should be held to a heightened standard of scrutiny. Using this rationale, the administration concluded that DOMA was unconstitutional. But now, House Speaker John Boehner is launching the process for the House of Representatives to defend the law itself. He says he'll convene a congressional advisory group that will decide whether to hire lawyers. To get some perspective on the Obama administration's recent announcement, FSRN's Jess Burns sat down with the executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, Kate Kendall. She asked Kate Kendall about the options available to Congress.
If the Attorney General and the Department of Justice do not defend a law passed by Congress, and there's precedent for this, Republicans in Congress are acting as if the sky has just fallen when the Obama administration made the decision to not defend DOMA, and yet there have been a number of laws under the Bush administration, under Clinton, that the Department of Justice did not defend. It's happened on a number of occasions before. And there's a procedure that if the administration chooses not to defend a law, Congress can hire its own lawyers and can step in themselves. It is their law, after all. They can step in and defend it. I think given how toxic the political climate is in D.C., that there is a possibility that Congress will step in and do that. I think it would be a ghastly misuse of resources and to take advantage of what many view as simply an ideological culture fight and use tax dollars to hire lawyers to defend a law that really is indefensible would be, I think, a very poor strategic call on their part.
Stepping back and looking at the original decision by the Obama administration, what are the policy implications of what the Justice Department announced?
There are two facets to what the administration did. The first is directly related to DOMA. It was coming to a point where the government was really at a moment where they had to fish or cut bait. They had to file briefs at the appellate court level, and we had been asking them for months, all of us who are doing this work, to no longer defend DOMA, that there was really no basis, given that Obama was on record saying that he thought DOMA was discriminatory, to be in court actually defending it, given that it so clearly discriminates on the basis of sexual orientation. But the other thing that the administration did that is even more important is they said that they were going to argue the court when they look at any laws that classify on the basis of sexual orientation, that they apply those laws to a higher level of scrutiny.
That was actually my next question. What are the implications of gays and lesbians being given heightened scrutiny status?
For the government to suggest that sexual orientation should be treated like gender, for example, and unless the government can show a good reason why it's discriminating, the law will be struck down. If it sticks, and it will stick as long as Obama is in office, and the longer he's in office, the more it will stick, and the more the law will change, and the more the courts will fall in line applying a heightened level of scrutiny. It could change the law in every area we've litigated on behalf of LGBT people for the last 34 years.
Is it expected that the Supreme Court will fall in line?
Once the government takes the position that a law should be subjected to heightened scrutiny, a court can choose to follow that direction, follow that analysis, or not. But most often, courts do acquiesce to the government's position. Because keep in mind, in talking about the DOMA litigation, for example, there are two parties to that litigation. There are the couples seeking to have their marriages recognized for federal purposes And there's the government. The government's the defendant. The government is now saying, we will no longer defend this law. So now, unless Congress intervenes, there's no one arguing before a court that the Defense of Marriage Act should be upheld. So assuming you have an objective judge, he looks or she looks at that evidence. No one is in court expressing to him or her that the law should be upheld. And under those circumstances, we think it's very likely that courts will strike down DOMA. And in other cases where the government is a party and is arguing to a court that it should apply heightened scrutiny, we think that will be very, it's a lot more persuasive to have the government saying heightened scrutiny should apply than us as the advocates.
How do you see the federal decision on DOMA affecting the local fights for same-sex marriage rights in the states?
I think we've seen in every previous civil rights fight, the tone set from policymakers at the highest level makes a difference. It's hard to shift in one's thinking. I mean, even President Obama says he's evolving on this issue. But I think that evolution is accelerated when policy decisions are made that say we should be in a better place.
Kate Kendall is the executive director of the Center for Lesbian Rights. Kate, thanks for speaking with me today.
My pleasure, Jess. Thank you.
That was FSRN's Jess Burns speaking to Kate Kendall, executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights. On the eve of controversial congressional hearings on radicalization in the American Muslim community, an increasing number of advocacy groups are warning about the rise in Islamophobia and discrimination against U.S. Muslims. And some of the people espousing these sentiments could be supported by taxpayer dollars. According to a 9-month-long investigation by the progressive think tank Political Research Associates, millions of dollars in counter-terrorism funding is being spent disseminating anti-Islamic myths. In a teleconference today, author of the 80-page report, Thomas Sincotta, described some of the material used in law enforcement trainings.
Training goes too far when participants in a course are required to read a book that says, terrorist acts may increase or decrease over time, but Islam remains permanently hostile. Training crosses a line when Islamic law texts are used to argue that violent jihad is a core tenet of the religion and an obligation of every practicing Muslim.
The report highlights a case in Henderson, Nevada, where police arrested a group of Muslim men who were simply praying in a gas station parking lot. One officer involved suggested his response was based on classes he'd gone to. The investigation looked at three major companies providing counter-terrorism training: the International Counter-Terrorism Officers Association, the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies, and Security Solutions International, and the people involved in teaching law enforcement. One of them is Walid Fares, who appears frequently on Fox, CNN, and NBC. In his book, Future Jihad, Fares writes, "Almost all mosques, educational centers, and socioeconomic institutions fall into their hands." After pressure from rights groups, Congress member King removed Fares from the witness list for Thursday's hearing, but said he might call him to testify in the future and vowed to continue consulting him for advice. Congress member Peter King's hearing has been widely criticized by civil rights and Muslim groups as an unfair attack on Muslim Americans that encourages prejudice. And some have compared it to McCarthy-era hearings and the attack on Japanese Americans during World War II. One group trying to counter the anti-Muslim assault is My Faith, My Voice. They've curated videos of ordinary Muslims to help promote understanding between Muslim and non-Muslim Americans.
Hi, America. My name is Rabia Ahmed, and I'm the proudest Detroiter you will ever meet. In recent weeks, a lot of people have been telling you what to think about Muslims. They say you should fear me. But the truth is, I don't want to impose my religion on you. Islam teaches me to respect all religions.
And Rabia Ahmed, who's also a co-founder of My Faith, My Voice, joins me now. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for having me.
What exactly prompted you to come up with the idea to start this project?
Well, the idea was born out of multiple conversations that a group of American Muslims were having during the month of Ramadan when the whole Part 51 controversy was taking place. We were really concerned about the rise of anti-Muslim rhetoric that we were seeing across the country. And, you know, as Americans, as parents, we felt like we needed to respond and let people hear our voices directly so that they can see for themselves who we really are and what we stand for.
When you were talking with your friends and colleagues about getting this project going, what other explanations did you come up with as to why this sort of anti-Muslim feeling has gone so far?
Well, you know, the Muslim community makes a very small fraction of the larger American population. And so when average Americans don't have personal relationships or exposure to Muslims on a regular basis, they're going to base their opinions and their perceptions of our community with what they see on TV. And, you know, all that you really see on TV are negative depictions of Muslims in Islam. And that's why we thought it was so important, so critical, to create a platform for people to come and visit, within their own comfort of their own homes and see the faces of our community, to see the diversity in our backgrounds, in our perspectives, and to see us, you know, talking about issues that they can relate to. It humanizes us. And so, you know, in the absence of other mainstream Muslim voices in the media and in the entertainment world, this is the next best thing that we can do to try to get that perspective out there.
Looking at your website, you've had quite a range of people contributing of all sorts of different ages. What are some of the contributions that have struck you?
It's great to see people really be creative with these videos. You see a Muslim woman who is talking, but she's holding up cards that basically dispel some of the stereotypes that people might have about Muslim women. Things like, was she forced into her marriage? Was she forced to wear her headscarf? Things of that nature. And then you have people take on more of a comedic approach to it, where they're kind of poking fun at themselves and, you know, the absurdities around misconceptions that people have about our community. Then you have people who, you know, incorporate their kids into the skit. So, you know, it's exactly what we want people to do. We want people to take ownership of it. We want it to be completely organic. We want people to basically speak for themselves, define who they are so that others don't.
You mentioned the headscarf, and in your YouTube video, you felt it was important to talk about that. Why was that?
Well, it's an interesting question. I was one of the first ones to upload a video. I wanted to, you know, to circulate out there as an example of what people can do. And I think the reason why I ended up talking about the headscarf is because I know that when people, first perception of one person sees me, they might be distracted by the headscarf. And they might not necessarily listen to what I'm saying, but rather just focus on, you know, what I look like. And so I wanted to kind of neutralize that by saying, look, this headscarf was not forced on me. You know, it's something that I'm proud of. I'm a proud Muslim. I wear this because I want to. It's not something that was imposed on me. And so that's why I chose that particular topic to discuss. But, you know, in the videos, we ask our participants to talk about what Islam teaches them. So it can be, you know, a variety of topics. It can be about what Islam teaches you about how to respect your neighbors, how to respect your environment, how to respect your parents. So it just depends on what's close to your heart.
Some conservative Christians have been behind fomenting quite a bit of anti-Muslim feeling in the U.S. What are your thoughts on what can be done to resolve that issue?
I think the responsibility lies with all of us. The American Muslim community needs to continue to engage with people and share their lives with people so that they can break down some of the barriers that might exist. Our leadership, interfaith leadership, needs to condemn these voices of hate, you know, encourage their constituents to not fall victim of people's, you know, political agendas. And our government needs to condemn those who try to, who use their positions of power to promote anti-Muslim agendas. It's a challenge that we all have to try to take on in our different ways. And it's a very daunting task, but something that needs to be dealt with.
Rabia Ahmed from My Faith, My Voice, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for having me.
In Thailand, an Air Force fleet has been dispatched on a mission to create artificial rain to ease drought problems across the country. The technique involves seeding clouds with rainfall-inducing chemicals. But Thailand suffers from both droughts and floods, and recently emerged from the most severe flood season in 50 years. Some say the country could counter the effects of dry seasons if the government better managed floodwaters. FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
In Thailand's northern provinces, the skies are clear and the riverbeds dry. The threat of drought looms over the region. Just a few weeks ago, media reports were telling a different story.
This has affected tens of thousands of people, including foreign tourists. Now, the water level in some districts was over 3 meters.
Flooding hit the northern and central provinces, as well as the southern border provinces near to Malaysia. The floods, the worst in half a century, claimed over 230 lives and caused more than $2 billion in damage. The water inundated farmlands and urban centres alike. Thailand has developed flood mitigation measures, including more than 40 miles of flood walls in the capital, Bangkok. But scientists and ecologists say more needs to be done. They are calling for the government to adopt policies to better manage the floodwaters as a resource to help offset the dry season and drought. Anon Sinivong is a climatologist at Bangkok's Chulalongkorn University.
We always look at water in the rainy season as an excess, as a waste, as something unwanted, and then get rid of it. And in the in dry season, we complain that okay, we don't have enough water. So this is, you need to change the attitude toward water. Don't look at it as a waste, but as it as an asset.
Anon recommends construction of water retention pools, not full dams, to store water during the rainy season. Others agree and want to see the government prioritize long-term water management policies. Architect Danai Tai Taku says rapid development in urban areas is also to blame.
The country needs to look at the water issue as a, let's say, national security. So it's not just a food security, it's water security. But, at the policy, the top policy level, like all ministry, they don't really take it.
Right, not taking it seriously.
Yes. It's just, you see that.
The Thai government has moved to centralise emergency and long-term water management programs from different ministries to within the Prime Minister's office. Some experts also suggest farmers and companies within affected areas develop their own long-term flood management plans. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
That's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. Thanks to KPFA, Nathan Moore, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.